So the president certainly has evolved. And he told me, of course, that, you know, he felt that his own election would have some incalculable benefits. You know, young people who never knew anything other than a black president have their mind set. I mean, it is true. You think about it. 8 years, kids who were born, they're like, why is a white person in the White House? That doesn't seem normal. That's something unimaginable for my generation, to be sure. But it would have that kind of impact, symbolically speaking. But the symbolism must be tethered to profound substantive and structural issues.
And in terms of this, whole issue of him not only obviously being the president of black Americans, but also the head of the imperial state of the United States,
which
is obviously, as you alluded obliquely to the debates you've had with other leading African-American figures, like obviously Cornel West, over this issue of how do you deal with the substantial and fundamental questions that people have about some of the policies he's implemented as president, while at the same time dealing with the reality that there's this enormous racist backlash against him among many Americans.
Well, that's the $64,000 question. And look, those kind of arguments should be made. My argument with Professor West wasn't about the substance of his argument to a certain degree. I did have substantive disagreements with him, but it was the tone. If you're going to say you're a Christian, you're not calling people's names, you know, talking about their mamas and talking about they're scared of a real black man. Well, part of the consternation Professor West endured is that when Obama saw him at the Urban League, he cussed him out. Is that black enough for you? Is that street enough for you? Let me get up in your grits and in your chest and thump you in a way that a black man will understand. Is that authentic for you? And I think that led to some resentment. Then West says, I want to slap him upside his head. Black people don't cotton too well to black people who are talking about the bodies of figures like Obama in public when the history of assault upon black females and males, because not only Freddie Gray, but Sandra Bland and many other black women who have been abused by the police. That suggests a history that I think Professor West was at least denying in deference to his righteous anger and outrage at what he saw as policies that should be opposed. Oppose them like you oppose any other presidents. Speak articulately and clearly about what you think is a problem. In my book, I have an entire chapter where I talk about black patriotism and Obama being the black face of an American empire and the consequences that that brings, which means that the internationalism that Paul Robeson and Martin Luther King Jr. put forth has been muted under this presidency. I say those things as well, but I ain't talking about his mama, I ain't talking about his dog, and I ain't talking about the public housing he lives in.
And the whole issue of the Latino community. I mean, you had one of the closest allies, the National Council of La Raza, President Janet Murguia, the shock that President Obama expressed when they called him the deporter-in-chief.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at the record. It was an empirically verifiable claim that they put forward. And did the White House expect that the price of support for certain issues and being a symbolic representative of minorities would be the silence and the muting, silencing and the muting of the voice? That would be pretty ridiculous, and that has to be pushed back on. And I think that when she made that statement and others among African Americans who pushed back even gently, there was obvious resentment for that and resistance to that. But the job of a social and cultural critic is to put that forth.
Well, we have to break here, but we're going to continue the conversation, and we'll post it at democracynow.org. Michael Eric Dyson, our guest, Georgetown University professor, his book, The Black Presidency, Barack Obama and the Politics of Race in America. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO, Portland. Up next, the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of This Changes Everything, Tuesday, February 9th, 6:30 p.m. at the Multnomah Arts Center Auditorium in Portland. This Changes Everything is a film directed by Avi Lewis and inspired by Naomi Klein's international bestseller of the same title that attempts to reimagine the vast challenge of climate change.
I've spent 6 years wandering through the wreckage caused by the carbon in the air and the economic system that put it there.
There will also be information and representatives from local groups involved in the climate change struggle. Again, that's Tuesday, February 9th, 6:30 p.m. at the Multnomah Arts Center Auditorium, 7688 Southwest Capitol Highway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting Clean Up the Willamette, the Portland Harbor Superfund site. This civic education program takes place Tuesday, February 9th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building Boardroom, 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard, or at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the Portland Youth Summit kicks off Friday night. We speak to founder Imani Muhammad.
Ted Cruz apologizes to Ben Carson for convincing voters he dropped out of the Iowa caucuses yesterday.
And on News from Lavoo, tonight we speak to the Contessa de la Luna about a big celebration for her 10th year on the airwaves.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Multnomah County Sheriff Dan Staton has been accused of sexual harassment and creating a hostile work environment. Chief Deputy Linda Yankee is the highest-ranking female deputy in the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department. She filed a claim Monday alleging that Sheriff Staton made sexual comments and derogatory statements in front of her. In addition, the deputy claims she was inappropriately touched by Staton, stating that he would shake his hands with male employees but insisted on hugging her. The claim also alleges that the deputy was demoted in retaliation for making statements about the county's financial troubles when the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office took over law enforcement for the city of Troutdale. The deputy says she was not the only target of verbal harassment by Staton, claiming that he had fat-shamed and used demeaning terms like stupid and bimbo to describe department staff members.
Today, Oregon legislators are considering a bill that would strengthen tenants' rights. If passed, the Housing Relief Act would require Oregon landlords to provide at least a 90-day notice to any tenant that has occupied a unit for when being given a no-cause eviction. The 90-day notice would also be required of landlords giving rent increases. Landlords would also have to pay renter relocation costs in the amount of 1 month's rent to help with moving expenses. The bill is being sponsored by Representative Alyssa Kenny Geyer. Representative Chris Gorsuch is also pursuing a similar bill that would extend no-cause eviction notices and rent increases.
The Corvallis-Benton County Public Library hosts a talk on the future of racial diversity in Oregon by Willamette University professor Emily Drew on Sunday, February 7th. The event, scheduled for 2 to 3:30, is free and open to the public. It's at the library downtown at 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. The event is hosted by the Corvallis chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice and sponsored by Oregon Humanities. The forum takes place in the context of recent revelations that the Ku Klux Klan have been recruiting in Silverton and that a Salem family received death threats in mid-January signed KKK.
The 9th annual Portland Youth Summit is coming up this weekend. The 10th annual. The event features workshops and speakers for adults and kids built around the five elements of hip-hop. Founder and organizer Imani Muhammad is here to speak with us about what's being featured this weekend. Imani, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So to get started, why don't you tell us why you started this event?
For sure. And just a point of correction, it's actually next weekend, February 12th and 13th. That's okay. Basically, this started off of a death of a young man, Devontae Lightfoot, who was killed in 2007 on the street of Albina in Killingsworth. I was his former teacher, and I knew him, I knew his family, and so forth. And so, from his death, it was something that I needed, that I felt that needed to be brought to the attention of adults and young people. And so the Youth Summit started as an opportunity to allow us as adults to give young people a platform and give them an opportunity to express themselves at the same time, get information and have fun along with it.
Great. Now, let's get the parent perspective from you. As somebody who works with kids in Northeast Portland, what do you see happening among Portland youth right now?
For sure. I'm also a mother as well. So, the young people are fearless is what I see them. I see them, they're engaged, they are artistic, they have a lot of energy, you know, and they're looking for also guidance, and they're looking for the right guidance. And so Portland youth are no different than any other youth, you know, across the nation. But what I see is that the opportunity that we have as adults is to give them a sense of purpose and a sense of identity, which is why we chose the theme this year of Know Thyself or Else, because ultimately we as people can't be great, can't, you know, go after what we want in life if we don't know what we like, why we like it, and who we really are. And so we want to try to give the young people some sense of identity this year at the Youth Summit.
And who are you serving with this program?
Right now, I mean, when we say youth, we're reaching everyone and anyone. Of course, you know, when it started, we were definitely looking at what people would classify as disadvantaged young people, predominantly Black and Brown. But at the same time, we know that what we offer is for all youth, whether they, you know, whatever class, color, creed, whatever category they want to fall under. If they're young, and if they're 55 and they're young, then it's for them. You know, I get so much out of the Youth Summit as an adult. And we try to have the components of young workshops and opportunities for adults to get inspired as well. So it's for everyone.
Wonderful. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the special guest, Devin James? What's he going to be talking about? Where is he coming from?
For sure. Devin James is actually an author. It's kind of a new piece added to who he is. He originally is from Memphis, but he I've learned of him through Ferguson right after the death of Mike Brown. His company was hired to do PR for the city of Ferguson. And so he has written a book, more of a tell-all, his own kind of personal memoir of what really what happened there, the connection between the community and government. And so much, you know, what that means. And so his book is his tell-all. And his connection to the Youth Summit, he is really trying to make sure that all young people get a copy of his book for free. And so he's going to be an awesome addition to the summit. And also, he's a young guy. So to hear his story and hear where he came from and how he is able to kind of work with governments and different entities, but also can connect with young people and adults. So he's definitely a highlight to the summit.
Great. And what else will be happening?
So much. I'm really excited about the partnership with Black Parent Initiative that has been an awesome partnership for us. They do a lot of parent workshops. So the Friday night, February 12th, is actually designated for parents. And so there's workshops on the theme is healing ourselves to raise our future, because we know as adults we have our own personal work. And we're always sometimes blaming young people for what they do. But guess what? We're their parents. So that's Friday night. I'm excited for that. And then Saturday, there's just a multitude of workshops. There's some workshops on the art of emceeing, so those that want to be lyricists or rappers. There's also a workshop on the truth, like just how do you discover truth, and just kind of, you know, along those lines, but again, along the themes of know thyself or else.
So this is the 10th year.
Yes.
This year,
yes.
Not the 9th. What are your longer-term goals for this summit and this larger project?
For sure. You know, ultimately, I always say that I don't plan to save the world in a weekend or on a Friday or Saturday, but we do aim to plant a seed in young people and in adults. So, you know, it is an annual event, and that's what it is. What I would love to see is that we can take what we do each year and do that monthly, you know, whether it's bringing a community together to do a community dialogue about things that are happening in their community, or whether we take some of the workshop presenters and do these on a monthly basis. There's so much that comes out of the summit that it's almost sad if we only do it once a year. I mean, there's networking, there's vendors, you know, from all over the community. There's such great partnerships that we have, you know, Multnomah County, and we have Boys and Girls Club of Portland, and we have so many different amazing partners that we should do it more than just once a year. So that's ultimately the future of what I see the nonprofit and the work that we're doing is presenting it to more communities and more often.
And what else can people in the community do to support this and support your work?
Well, you know, as a nonprofit, financial contributions are always great, you know, because it does cost for all of us to put anything on, and also to compensate, you know, presenters that come. I mean, most of the presenters, all the presenters, I should say, they do it because they love the work. But love doesn't pay bills. So if we can, you know, generate some financial contributions, that's great. And also just supporting it, passing the word, sharing a flyer if you see it on social media, encouraging people to attend, and then, of course, show up yourself. So that's the best way.
And what kind of feedback do you tend to get from kids who participate?
Amazing feedback. One person who's actually who's the host of our talent show that we have, his name is Baki Coles. He's a senior now, but he started at the summit as a young, probably 9 years old, just being around and heard about the summit, and now he won the talent show last year, and now he's hosting the talent show. And we actually just conversed a couple of days ago, and just his transformation as a young man, but always he goes back to, yeah, I remember when I performed at the summit. That was his first performance ever. And now, you know, look how he is now. He can grab the mic, he can perform, he's doing music videos and things like that. Went to Africa. I mean, you know, so there's those stories, like you take Baki and you can just multiply that across, you know, so many young people and adults that have been connected.
Yeah, and we actually had him on the show about two months ago.
Nice.
Like, so before he went on his trip to Africa. So.
Right on.
Yeah.
Yeah, he and Mike Crenshaw actually met at the summit. And so look at their journey now. So that is exactly like what the Youth Summit can do.
One last question. For those in the listening audience who might not know, what are the five elements of hip hop?
Ooh, that's a great question. Let's see if I remember. The five elements are hip hop, of course, is the B-boy and B-girl. So that's the dance movements. That's the, you know, the pop locking that we see. You have the DJ, who's always moving the crowd. You have the MC, who is the person that drops the knowledge and drops the information. You have, let me see the fourth element. Oh, graffiti. Sorry. You have graffiti, which is the artistic element. And of course, the fifth element, which is sometimes the hidden, is the knowledge. Because hip hop always came about, you know, of a culture that was bringing information and community awareness. So the fifth element is knowledge.
Great. Thank you. And why don't you give the listeners the dates and times one more time?
For sure. So February 12th and 13th, next weekend at the Blazer Boys and Girls Club at 5250 Northeast MLK. You get all the information at portlandyouthsummit.org.
Thank you. We've been talking with Imani Muhammad, founder and organizer of the Portland Youth Summit. You can find out more about the event online at www.portlandyouthsummit.org. Thanks.
Thank you.
Public hearings were held yesterday for House Bill 4036. This bill aims to rid Oregon electricity of its coal-fired plants by the year 2030. The proposed bill is a compromise between power plants and environmental groups. It states that a move to cleaner energy is possible and could be achieved with little to no cost for the ratepayers. Compared to current policies, this would cut Oregon's carbon emissions by 35 million tons annually. The plan will have PGE and Pacific Power customers in Oregon stop paying for coal-fired power by 2030. That's with the exception of the Colstrip power plant in the Puget Sound, which may have an extension up to 2035. The legislation, as it currently is written, includes the goal of all renewable energy in Oregon by 2040.
On January 26, the EPA and the Portland Harbor Citizen Advisory Group for the Superfund site on the Willamette River held the first of many citizen hearings about the EPA's upcoming decision on cleaning up the Willamette River. That plan, referred to as the Document of Record, will be released at the end of March. This marks the end of over a decade of feasibility studies, citizen input, and collaboration with some of the companies and individuals on a list of possible responsible parties. After the release of the formal plan for cleanup in March, there will be a 60-day public comment period. The EPA and the Citizen Advisory Group urge people to get involved in the public meetings before the plan is released to familiarize themselves with the different options. KBOO News reporter Kristen Yount recorded a portion of the Q&A part of the January 26th hearing.
I'm not going to comment on which of the alternatives will get there faster and everything else, or which one we think is best, because we haven't made that final decision yet. We propose perhaps capping and dredging in a certain amount of the area and leaving the rest to monitor natural recovery. I want to point out that risk is a function of concentration, and you know, we will be reducing concentrations in the river, and those concentrations will continue to go down. What we're looking at and what we're focusing on right now in the feasibility study is, at the end of construction, What are the concentrations going to be? What we don't have is a mechanism or a defensible mechanism to say, if we do X amount of dredging and so many acres of capping at the end of that time, we can predict what we expect the concentrations in various areas of the river to be, what those concentrations in sediment would mean in terms of concentration in fish, what the risk would be, how many fish you could safely eat in a given time period. Those concentrations will continue to decrease, but we don't have a mechanism to actually predict those, the rates of decrease beyond that. I want to point out that as a toxicologist, I can tell you what's a safe concentration in those fish, and I think we need to start managing expectations. We will never completely get there. And there are contaminants that are feeding into this river system from other areas that we have no control over. And even that concentration is going to leave us at the end of the day with an unsatisfactory result. And certain people are going to need to think about it before they eat a lot of fish. I mean, the average person should be able to eat fish on a fairly regular basis. But certain people, and particularly women who are childbearing age and plan to have children and nurse those children, they're going to need, for the foreseeable future, to think about whether or not they want to eat a lot of fish out of Portland Harbor. That's just the reality.
This is unscripted, but I want to say one thing, because if it's not said, it might get left undone. You know, the EPA has been working on this site going on 16 years. I've never seen an agency that has been more beleaguered by a narrative that has been spun, from my perspective, by certain members of our community, especially the potentially responsible parties who are ultimately responsible for cleaning this site up, or at least contributing to it, lambasting our federal employees over and over, filing formal disputes over that time span, providing information and or work products that have not met their standards, and they have to turn around and ask for the job to be done right in some circumstances. And guess what happens in the media? They point at the EPA and say, oh, the EPA is not making a decision. They're not getting the job done. Meanwhile, behind closed doors, some of those same entities are saying, slow down, you guys are moving too fast.
Speaking in that clip was Jim Robinson of the Portland Harbor Citizen Action Group and Travis Williams, Executive Director of Willamette River Keepers. For more information about the cleanup, see www.portlandharborcag.info. The next meeting takes place February 4th at the City Building at 1120 Southeast 5th Avenue at 11 a.m.
Prosecutors in Los Angeles filed four criminal charges against Southern California Gas Company for the utility's failure to disclose a methane leak in a timely fashion. Failing to notify regulatory authorities of such ruptures carries a maximum fine of $25,000 per day, and the company did not notify authorities for 3 days once the leak was discovered. Additional fines at the rate of $1,000 a day for every day the well is polluting the air can also be levied. The charges came just hours after California's Attorney General joined 11 other petitioners suing the gas company, claiming the action is necessary to hold the utility accountable. A spokesperson for the utility insists they will defend themselves vigorously through the judicial process. The Southern California Gas Company is a subsidiary of Sempra Energy, whose board of directors includes member Kathleen Brown, sister of Governor Jerry Brown. The arraignment is scheduled for February 17th in Santa Clarita.
Congress heard testimony this morning regarding events leading up to the water crisis in Flint. However, some public officials skipped the hearing. State and federal environmental officials who showed up were questioned at length about their agency's response efforts. State officials relied on technical compliance with the law instead of assuring safe drinking water, according to the director of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. The hearing lasted roughly 4 hours and included two separate panels of witnesses. Here's more from KBOO reporter Robin Ryan about today's hearing.
Prior to opening statements at this morning's hearing before the House Oversight Committee, the chairman entered a group of documents into the record. These documents included a request for the United States Marshal's Office to serve a subpoena to the attorney of Darnell Early, as the former emergency manager of Flint has declined the committee's invitation to attend today's proceedings. Other documents concern redacted emails from former EPA Region Chief Susan Hedman, whose resignation was announced late in January and became effective on Monday. Hedman has promised to provide unredacted versions of this correspondence by Friday, but is now also being summoned to testify. Panelists today included renowned water safety expert Mark Edwards, who gained recognition in the early 2000s when high levels of lead were detected in the drinking water in Washington, D.C. Here's an excerpt of his address to the committee members.
The agencies involved in protecting children from lead in drinking water in this country, including the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, the EPA, primacy agencies, and the water utilities, have proven themselves time and time again unworthy of the public trust. They cannot be trusted to fix this problem. They've repeatedly engaged in scientific misconduct, and in the written testimony I submitted to the committee, I outline over the last 10 years five examples of falsified reports from these agencies that have conclusions directly endangering children in this country that have caused children to be lead poisoned, and they refuse to correct the scientific record, even in the case of an EPA report that they now acknowledge has no data. After 9 years, I've tried to get this report corrected. They refuse to retract this report. Their callous disregard for the most vulnerable amongst us has really played out most recently in Flint, Michigan. And residents there have been living a surreal experience. It's part 1984, part enemy of the people. And I am personally shamed that the profession I belong to, the drinking water industry in this country, has allowed this to occur. Do what these agencies have refused to do. Protect kids in this country from lead in drinking water, and let's make them live up to their noble mission and once again be worthy of the public trust.
Also on hand to testify was Flint area resident Leanne Waters, who contacted Edwards in 2015 to conduct independent tests of Flint's drinking water after feeling less than satisfied with the city's methods.
My home used to be a place of comfort and safety for my family. It used to be what a home should be, a place of peace and protection from the outside world. That was taken from us, and not just from my family, but from every home and every citizen in Flint. Now my home is known as Ground Zero. In 2014, in a city with no democracy, forced under an emergency manager, handpicked by Governor Snyder, a decision was made to switch the water source without the proper testing and enforcement of regulation. The MDEQ claims they misinterpreted federal law regarding corrosion control. They were allowed to tell EPA they were following the law without any verifications. The citizens in Flint were assured for 18 months that the water was safe. Broken policy and procedures are smothering the outcry of an entire community suffering financially, physically, mentally, and emotionally. I urge you to help restore some of the trust lost and protect all the citizens in the United States by never allowing this to happen again. We need this to happen now, not 10 years from now.
I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016. At 6 o'clock, Treasures from the Vault features a documentary about Bessie Smith. That'll be followed by Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow's weather is calling for steady rain in the morning and afternoon, with a high of 51 and a low of 40. Today in history, in 1690, the colony of Massachusetts issued the first paper money in North America. The quote of the day comes from Nelson Mandela, who said, "Money will not create success. The freedom to make it will."
It's 5:28, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The mantra of every coke-headed right-wing politico is that government should be run like a business. Welcome to Flint, Michigan. This impoverished, mostly African-American city has indeed been run like a private corporation ever since Governor Rick Snyder appointed a, quote, emergency manager to seize control of Flint's heavily indebted local government. Snyder's coup d'etat usurped the people's democratic voice and enthroned an autocratic CEO who's answerable only to Snyder. As in corporations, Flint's manager is focused not on serving the people, but on the bottom line. His mandate from the governor was to slash costs ruthlessly so bankers and other holders of the city's debt can be paid off. Snyder's czar proved to be an enthusiastic slasher, including cutting a couple of million dollars from the budget in 2014 by shifting the source of the city's drinking water from Lake Huron to the Flint River. Sure, some scaredy cats worried about contaminants in that river, but Snyder's health officials poo-pooed them. Indeed, the beauty of one-man rule is that you can ignore the people and take bold, decisive action. That's what corporate CEOs do, and even if there is some collateral damage, it's the bottom line that matters. But oops, the bottom line of thinking you can simply apply corporate methods and ethics to public responsibilities is that very bad things can happen. In this case, Flint's water supply is contaminated with lead. Its entire infrastructure of water pipes needs to be replaced. Thousands of the city's children may be permanently impaired by lead poisoning, and Snyder's name is mud. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we have here is proof that government cannot be run like corporations, which serve the few, not the many. Despite the shallow sloganeering of ideologues, government has to be run like, well, like a government.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Republican presidential hopeful Ted Cruz is being accused of cheating during the Iowa caucus. Cruz is alleged to have spread a false rumor that fellow Republican candidate Ben Carson had dropped out of the race while the caucuses were still happening. The Cruz campaign says a campaign staffer reportedly heard a CNN news story that Carson would be returning to Florida after the caucus rather than going to New Hampshire or South Carolina. That staffer allegedly interpreted the story incorrectly, leading him to report that Carson had already suspended his campaign. Another Cruz campaign staffer issued an email shortly afterward to precinct captains urging caucus goers to caucus for Cruz since Carson had supposedly already dropped out of the race. Ted Cruz offered an apology on Tuesday morning to the Carson campaign, calling the actions of his staffer a mistake. Although Carson accepted the apology, the Carson campaign is calling for the staffer who spread the false rumor to be fired. The Carson campaign emphasized on Tuesday that Carson is not suspending his bid for the White House, and he will continue his campaign.
Gun deaths are 25 times higher in the United States than in any other populous high-income country. That's according to researchers analyzing the World Health Organization's 2010 mortality data. The data showed that homicide rates are 7 times higher in the United States, but in incidents of homicide due to guns, that rate jumps to a rate of 25 times higher.
An American pro-rape blogger has organized an international meetup day this week for his supporters. The self-described pickup artist known as Roosh V is hosting events this weekend in over 100 cities worldwide. Roosh V is infamous for his controversial books that claim to show the best methods for men to have sex with women. His anti-feminist website advocates for legalizing rape on private property anywhere in the United States. Events have been scheduled locally in Seattle and Everett, Washington. Local protesters are planning to protest these so-called secret events in support of women's rights. Online activists have started a petition on Amazon.com calling for the removal of his books from their website. Roosh V is just one of several prominent self-proclaimed pickup artists who've made the news recently for their pro-rape views. Several countries have blocked these men from receiving visas, including Australia, where Roosh V claims he will be on Saturday's planned events.
Europe's refugee crisis continues unabated. The European Union's Central Police Agency, Europol, says that thousands of refugee children are unaccounted for. Jacob Resnick reports.
Europol has been poring over refugee registration figures and has found something disturbing. Out of the more than a million migrants that crossed into the EU last year, the current whereabouts of thousands of minors is unknown.
The figure of 10,000, I think, would be a conservative estimate across all the countries that are dealing with this migrant crisis.
That's Europol Chief Brian Donald. The fact that children are lost in the system doesn't necessarily mean they are in the hands of criminal gangs. Many are probably still with family and guardians. But the lack of accountability does mean there are thousands who have fallen through the cracks, and that makes them vulnerable to exploitation.
They're lost in the system is the phrase that I heard used today. I think that's a good way of putting it. I mean, I think our concern is that we know that there are people out there who will exploit minors. We know there are people who will take them and use them for their own purposes. We're just trying to raise awareness that this is something that everybody should be aware of.
Europol says there are established links between organizations known for human trafficking and smugglers who are helping refugees clandestinely cross borders and enter the EU. European leaders will meet next month for another summit on the migrant crisis, but individual member states remain bitterly divided on how to respond to the hundreds of thousands that continue to flee war, strife, and poverty for the relative safety of Europe. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Bonn.
While most cities have pigeons, Lima, Peru has vultures. These birds have been seen as a symbol of the city's decay and neglect. However, a new project is attempting to improve the vulture's image while simultaneously combating the city's trash problem. Environmental authorities have begun equipping vultures with GPS trackers and GoPro cameras, sending them out to do what they do best, find trash dumps. The idea is that the birds will find illegal dumping grounds, which can then be marked. Unfortunately, just because the vultures find illegal dumping sites, it does not necessarily mean that they will be cleaned up. The job of keeping the streets clean falls to the municipalities, many of which simply do not have the resources to do so. Still, the project hopes to change people's habits by encouraging them to be vultures on the ground, by reporting illegal dumping, cutting back on their waste, and by recycling.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 600 good American jobs are at stake in Chicago as Mondelez, Nabisco's parent company, sends those jobs to Mexico. Ron Baker of the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers, Local 300, says the company got millions of dollars in tax relief, but still decided to chase low wages in Mexico anyway.
It's not only the 600 jobs here, which are good-paying jobs, but it's also the 2 to 3 times that many spin-off jobs of suppliers. So this will devastate the South Side, which would be direly impacted by these moves.
With the first round of 277 layoffs expected March 21st, the union is fighting to save the jobs. And if the jobs go, Baker says Americans shouldn't buy Mexican-made Nabisco products.
If we can't be involved both in the production and in the purchase of these products, our goal is to educate people to say don't buy Mexican-made products because it's a one-way street, and it's not fair to American workers.
A million anti-TPP petition signatures are being sent to Congress as opposition to the trade deal kicks into high gear. A Broadway-style song has been produced to go with the Let It Go campaign against the TPP.
Let it go, let it go, throw the TPP out the door. Here we stand, and to Congress we say, TPP vote no, or you better watch out on election day.
The Chicago Teachers Union is rallying Thursday against mass layoffs announced by Chicago schools. The union says halting the pension pickup payments also amounts to a 7% pay cut for teachers. CTU says it spent 15 months trying to get a serious offer out of the school board on a new contract for teachers. The Chicago Public Schools proposal rejected by the union would have cut more than 2,000 educators from the system. It would have done nothing to reduce class sizes and included no specific revenue proposals for stable school funding. Chicago Teachers Union says the school board has shut down the flag of truce and peace talks are over. Thursday's rally in March starts at the Bank of America and ends at City Hall. United Auto Workers members at GM are getting up to $11,000 in profit sharing this year. The UAW says the workers will go home to their families knowing that their hard work and innovative teamwork have paid off. Collective bargaining won the profit sharing checks for UAW GM workers. The union says as a result, the workers are sharing in the quality products and record sales of GM cars and trucks. WIN is made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteers-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenna Yokoyama, Grace Ann Smith, Jimmy Tardy, Galen Sanford, Kristen Yount, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Representative Kurt Schrader can be reached at 503-557-1324. And Representative Greg Walden is at 541-389-4408. In addition, Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO in Portland at 90.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River at 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Jason Renault from the Mental Health Association of Oregon about the fatal shooting of 19-year-old Christopher Kalonji by two Clackamas deputies and the role the DA should play in answering community questions. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, News You're Not Supposed to Know. At 9:30, host Per Fagering looks at how the U.S. Empire paved the way for the Islamic State. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Lisa Loving speaks with writer Alifair Burke about her new suspense novel, The X. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, Rosemary Reed Miller discusses her book, Threads of Time, The Fabric of History, which profiles African-American dressmakers and designers from 1850 to the present. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned for news from the Boo.
For KBOO News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer.
Yes, that's right. It is once again time for News from the Boo, our weekly program, Wednesdays after the news, where we discuss items of interest and importance to the station and the greater listening community. Our phone lines will be open tonight if you'd like to call with a question or a comment. Our number is 503-231-8187. Again, if you want to call in, that is 503-231-8187. Tonight, we are being joined by station co-manager Monica Beamer and also by John Wolfert, who is a KBOO engineering volunteer and a contractor who's building a new production room here at KBOO. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Before we get to what you guys have, we have Contessa de la Luna on the line calling in all the way from Monaco to tell us about an upcoming event that you don't want to miss. The annual KBOO benefit, Contessa de la Luna's Valentine Spectacular, this year also celebrating 10 years of the confessional radio show on KBOO 90.7 FM. Hello, Contessa, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. How are you?
How are you doing today?
Well, very well.
Excellent. Well, tell us a little bit about your radio show on KBOO on Sunday nights. Tell us about the confessional.
Well, that is Sundays at midnight. We got the call-in program with the music. And people call in, you know, and they get out of their chest what is weighing on their shoulders.
And can listeners download podcasts of your show?
Oh, yes, they can find it either on KBOO.FM or they can find it on the SoundCloud. They just look for Contessa de la Luna.
Well, tell us a little bit more about what you'll be doing for your 10-year anniversary.
All right. What we'll be doing, right? So, first of all, we got a lot of audience participation. So, like Contessa, she is going to perform. And then we're going to have a lot of prizes. We're going to have animal impersonation contest with audience. The Mike Crenshaw, he will perform. We will have the Human Shadow Puppy Theater. We're going to have a David Bowie kazoo tribute. So many different activities and the world premiere of the cable access La Contessa television program.
The television program. Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, we got a public access TV show that we make, and we're going to debut it at the show.
When and where is this? Congratulations on 10 years.
Oh, grazie.
And when and where is this event?
Well, that's right. It's a week from tomorrow. Thursday, February 11th, 7 to 9:30 p.m., Clinton Street Theater, where they use the Marlon Brando approved real butter on their popcorn. And we're also going to be giving away Contessa de la Luna surprise fun bag, lots of raffles, all proceeds benefit the KBOO Community Radio tickets.